is the full story at WSHU and WSHU.org. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. We start our weekly news roundup with the international tech giant Amazon. Yesterday, Amazon abandoned its plans to locate one of its two new headquarters in Long Island City. The deal was expected to bring 25,000 jobs to the city, but local politicians, residents, and activists objected to billions in tax breaks the company was promised by the city and state. NPR's business correspondent Alina Selyuk has been covering this story. She joins us now from Washington, and we do want to say that Amazon is an underwriter of NPR. Alina, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Alina, how this deal was a year in the making. How did it unravel, at least outside observers say, so quickly?
I think it was even for some inside observers relatively quickly. We were hearing from some local groups who were in meetings with Amazon officials as early as Thursday morning, and folks in those meetings seemed to not know that this was coming. But to summarize, it was essentially Amazon was unprepared for the level of vocal opposition that they faced in Queens. There are several elements that played into this decision. One was the scathing criticism that the company faced in recent city council hearings. And this stemmed from the city council being very upset about the fact that Amazon had picked an approval process for the deal that involved the mayor and the governor, but gave city council no real power over the deal. Then add to that this sort of rise of the progressive left that has swept through New York City politics. An illustrative example is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was elected from a district that is near the area where Amazon wanted to build its new HQ2. And her outspoken criticism echoes some of the criticism from other local and state politicians from that area who came out strongly opposing this deal. And then never underestimate the power of New York advocacy groups to mobilize. Union groups, housing groups, all kinds of groups came together to stage protests at those city council hearings where Amazon was getting pummeled with questions.
Let's go back just for listeners who may not be clear on what Amazon was promised by the city and state and in return what the city and state was going to get from the company. Can you highlight some of those points for us?
Sure. I mean, this search for HQ2, which was originally supposed to be one HQ2 and ended up being split into two, was a pretty remarkable deal. Amazon was saying that they would have a total of 50,000 jobs. So this way now it's getting split half and half, or was supposed to be getting split half and half. So New York City was looking at getting upwards of 25,000 jobs, paying an average salary of six figures, so really well-paying jobs, looking to be located in a neighborhood of Long Island City, which doesn't really have a huge tech presence. And in exchange, Amazon had solicited quote-unquote incentives from states and cities who were bidding for their presence. And New York City and New York State came up with this package that was valued at almost $3 billion in various tax breaks and incentives.
But the company had hit certain goals to get that full amount of money. This wasn't going to be a blank check or a $3 billion check that was going to be handed over from day one. Correct?
Yes. This was hinging on their ability to deliver the jobs and the kind of investment that they were promising.
Critics say the way the deal went forward was part of the problem, that it was behind closed doors, it didn't go through regular channels, it was not communicated well to the public. Is that a fair statement?
I mean, this is actually how usually these deals get done. So it's not unusual in the world of economic development, but it is unusual, or it was very sort of unusual to look in on from the perspective that Amazon started this process so publicly. You know, they put out the solicitation for bids from cities so publicly. They publicly asked for essentially subsidies. They were making this big push, it was so high profile, and then pivot to New York City, getting this headquarters, nobody really saw it coming. I mean, somebody saw it coming, but from the bigger picture, very few people could have predicted that this HQ2 process was going to land in the two very large hubs already, New York and D.C. And it's important to note that New York already has one of the biggest Amazon presences in the country outside of Seattle.
All right, is that the one on Staten Island?
They are actually all over New York City. There's advertising business. Some of their fashion folks are there. It's a pretty big pretty big presence. But to your point, as I was mentioning earlier, the city council really, really took issue with the fact that there were multiple ways to go through sort of land approvals and all kinds of approvals that they needed. And Amazon picked a path that was most efficient for them, which was, you know, you get the mayor and the governor, and then there's this board that also gets to review the incentive package, but essentially circumnavigates City Hall, and the city council is really upset about that. And then in addition, sort of piggybacking off of the rise of this progressive left-leaning politicians within the community, Senate leader had just recently appointed an ardent critic of Amazon's deal to the state board that had essentially control over Amazon's plan for Queens, and theoretically he could have had veto power over this plan, and that was one of the latest kind of developments that I think was one of the kind of turning points for
that
the
was
company.
Mike Gennaris, in terms of appointing him, that's his
yes.
his district, right?
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk a little bit about Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio. They really wanted to show that this was a way to diversify the city's economy. What does this mean to each of them?
It's kind of interesting. A lot has been said about the fact that the two of them really had to work hard to put aside their differences to broker this massive deal. And the two of them were kind of blaming different things for what fell apart. Cuomo was actually saying this was all political posturing from local politicians, and he was saying, you know, given that polls had shown New Yorkers were supporting Amazon's presence there, he was saying, you know, eventually these state and local politicians will have to answer for the loss of these jobs in front of the voters. Whereas de Blasio just kind of said it was Amazon's fault, in not directly in such terms, but he just kind of said, you have to be tough to make it in New York City, is the direct quote from his Twitter account. He says, you know, New York gave Amazon the opportunity and Amazon decided to throw that opportunity away.
Governor Cuomo essentially turned on his own party, didn't he?
In a way, well, there's a lot of very intense dynamics going on in New York politics.
Well, that's a good point. Was Amazon naive in going into negotiations with New York City that it was going to be different than negotiating with any other city in the United States?
It's such a peculiar situation. You know, a lot. I've been asked this question a lot. It's sort of, you know, what fell apart. I'm sure we'll be picking that apart for months to come. But this was so peculiar because, to your point, it's very unclear who needed whom most in this situation. Amazon is big and powerful, and it clearly wanted to be in New York. It's a very easy place to attract talent. But on New York City is also big and powerful, and it already has a huge Amazon presence, and it already adds tens of thousands of jobs every year. So they were kind of this really powerful match, and I think both sides heavily miscalculated the dynamic that they were walking into and the political dynamic that they were walking into, especially in the context of the midterm elections.
And then once Amazon got into it, did this become an issue in part of reputation management? In other words, it's going to be drip, 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 or maybe not, full throttle at some point, with anti-Amazon language, and it's going to be on social media, and it's going to be in papers, it's going to be on television, and we just don't need to have our reputation tarnished that way.
It's hard. I mean, to be a fly on the wall in those meetings would have been very interesting. But I know that from my reporting, from essentially like day one, there were already people kind of saying inside Amazon, like, do I really want to get into this? Because almost from day one, what you're saying, the social media outpours, the vocal, very loud criticism of Amazon started pouring out. And it's, you know, it's important to say that there were plenty of supporters. They just were not nearly as vocal as the critics.
Interesting in terms of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the newly elected congresswoman, how important was she, perhaps not spearheading the resistance, but certainly continuing to energize it?
Well, I think she's sort of the illustration of this shift, of the shift of the political tide in New York. And having her ride this wave of, you know, anti-corporate expansions to the high office I think, energized, as to use your term, right, the folks on the ground in Queens, but also broader New York, to say, you know, maybe we should stand with our opposition and be really loud and see what happens. And in the end, you know, Amazon decided that they didn't want to be beat up in the news and in the streets and in the banners constantly.
Go ahead.
No, that was it.
Okay. So what's next for Long Island City? Amazon doesn't sound like they're coming back to the table. They're moving on.
Right.
But who knows? Things can change quickly, as we've just seen this past week. What do you think is ahead for Long Island City?
It's hard to say. I'm curious. I mean, that is the question, is what happens to this area? I mean, to be clear, the area where Amazon was going to build its headquarters is not abandoned. It's not empty, in contrast to what's going on in Virginia. In Virginia, they're going into an area that does have a lot of just empty offices and not much going on. So in this case, it's not like, you know, there's this empty space that Amazon's not going to be there. But of course, I'm sure there'll be lots of pressure for the local officials to be able to say, you know, well, we gave up on Amazon because we didn't want to forego all of this tax revenue. And instead, here's maybe some local businesses that are growing. I'm sure this will be a question they will indeed face for months to come.
All right, Alina, thank you so much for joining us. Never dull in New York City, certainly not when it comes to big deals like this.
And also never dull in Amazon land.
That's right. All right. Alina Selyukh, NPR's business correspondent, joining us today as we discuss Amazon pulling out of HQ2 on Long Island City. We're continuing our conversation on Amazon's decision this week not to build its second headquarters, or one of two second headquarters, in Long Island City. Joining me now is Kevin Law. He is the president and CEO of the Long Island Association and supported the Amazon deal. Thanks for joining us today, Mr. Law.
Hi, call me Kevin.
All right, Kevin, I will. You can call me Becky. How's that?
Okay, Becky.
I would like to read a statement that you issued yesterday for our listeners, and that is, you wrote, Amazon's decision to not open its HQ2 in our region will go down as one of the biggest debacles in New York State history, and the elected officials who are responsible for this epic disaster should be ashamed of themselves for jeopardizing thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in tax revenue. So you truly believe this is one of the biggest debacles in New York history?
Yes, and I'm sorry for being so timid in my response yesterday.
So how did this go so wrong? And it, from your point of view, others say it went so right.
Well, you know what? I think most of this was politics. And that's unfortunate because this was a well-publicized national competition. And I know because I participated in parts of it. We helped coordinate the Long Island region's response with the New York State Empire State Development Corporation. And I participated in meetings with Long Island officials, New York City officials, and the Lower Hudson Valley officials. Upstate New York had a sort of a separate process through an upstate partnership because Buffalo and Rochester areas were also pitching for the competition. And so we all agreed that, hey, we'd all like it in our own backyard, and we had sites in Suffolk County and Nassau County in the mix, and Westchester had some sites. But we all agreed that if Amazon was to happen anywhere in the metropolitan region, it would be good for all of us. And, you know, so the sites that were proposed were not secret. They were well, reported. You know, everybody knew Long Island City was in the mix, you know, and everybody knew parts of Long Island were also in the mix. And so, you know, I find it really bizarre, you know, that politicians talk about, well, we didn't really know anything about it. Now, you can't conduct confidential negotiations in public. or through a a public hearing process. It's just not how deals get done. And so I think those arguments are also disingenuous.
Did Amazon or those that supported the second headquarters in Long Island City, did they fail in making the case to the public? And in such a way that residents would say, okay, we are going to benefit. This company, the richest in the United, one of the richest in the United States, biggest in the world, richest man at the helm. Okay, that's going to be okay because we in New York are going to benefit from this and in the region. That message just wasn't conveyed clearly enough.
Yeah, well, I think they clearly could have done a better job in communicating all of the benefits and not just highlighting the jobs. You know, but, you know, there were also the potential for a lot of other benefits. And so they had some time to do that. And certainly, in retrospect, they didn't do that well. I agree with you.
Did Amazon, we talked about this, and I know you were able to listen to our previous segment talking about Amazon and perhaps going into this not fully aware how difficult it is to negotiate a deal in New York City, somewhat naive. Do you think that was the case?
Nah, I think Amazon has probably the smartest, some of the smartest business folks on their team, and they had, I'm sure, good, New York City legal and financial representation as well. So I don't buy that argument. What I'm surprised at is, again, none of the real negative political reaction that we've witnessed over the last 2 months was out there when Long Island City was in the mix in terms of competition. And once the decision was actually, made, this all sort of happened after the fact. And so, again, I think some of the political arguments are somewhat disingenuous.
Do you think perhaps it was that folks just weren't paying attention, and then all of a sudden you get some vocal opposition using language like anti-worker policies, fuel displacement, collaborate with ICE, raid public coffers, that all of a sudden got folks' interest?
Yes, and you're right. The opponents did a terrific job of spinning those issues. And you're right. The positive impacts were not highlighted enough. And so, that's unfortunate because there were a lot of positive impacts. Your guest, who was on right before me, made a point that I believe is worth repeating in an answer to one of your questions. Some of the elected officials are talking about the state and city incentives were so large and too large, and that they should rather be used for investments in education or infrastructure or our subways. But the great, great majority of the incentives were known as Excelsior tax credits. And you don't get the tax credit until after you create the job. And so no job, no tax credit. And so it's a credit after the fact. It's not like there's this $3 billion pot of money that is now available that can be used for the subways or for education. And so that is one of the biggest misleading arguments that is going on with the opposition. And unfortunately, that prevailed over the facts. The country's great about talking about fake news these days. Man, that was the biggest fake news of the year.
When it came to job creation, though, for 25,000 workers, was it written into the deal that a certain percentage were going to have to be workers that were local workers, not workers that were hired from outside the region?
Well, I haven't read the the entire deal, but whenever a company locates anywhere in our region, they do their own analysis of where the labor pool will come from, and New York City is still look at it as a wheel, the spokes go out into Connecticut, onto Long Island, and into northern New Jersey. And so people are going to come from still the tri-state region for jobs in the city. But there is some of the largest public housing projects in the city that are in Long Island City, people of moderate means. There were opportunities for, you know, folks in that community to get jobs at Amazon, as well as folks throughout all of Queens. And so, again, I think it was a missed opportunity for a lot of the residents there who would have liked to have had a career as opposed to a job.
Well, what does this mean now for the economy in Long Island and then New York City going forward?
Well, I think this is, again, terrible news for our region, our city, and our state. I think we need, in terms of being viewed as receptive to growth, economic development, and business, I think there are two issues to point out. One, when and if these jobs were created, you know, Amazon was going to generate close to $30 billion over the next several years in revenues. A lot of those monies could have been used to invest in our subways, our communities, and our education system. You know, that money will no longer be generated. And, you know, listen, I like a lot of the investments that we should be making in our communities and in our education. We just held an event here yesterday on child care and how important it is to invest in pre-K and good quality child care because we need to view that as an economic development issue. And unless the state and the city have revenues coming in, it's tough to do some of these other worthy social progressive investments that we need to be making. So that's one issue. The other issue is, if you look at our region statistically, New York City, you know, Manhattan, Queens, Long Island, statistically, things were already going well. You know, one of the lowest unemployment rates in our history, you know, hovering around 3%. We have a sales tax increase in both the city and the island. And real estate values were good. A lot of development was already happening in Long Island City. And so we're not going to feel the impact today because right now, and I don't diminish anybody who doesn't have a job or, you know, or who's, you know, struggling to meet their monthly bills, but I'm saying statistically, the region is doing well. And so we're not going to feel this pain immediately. Long term, we'll feel it. But what we will feel immediately is that if you're a businessman or woman thinking about locating to our region or maybe expanding in our region, you're going to have second thoughts because you are witnessing a very anti-business, anti-invest in our communities type of attitude. And whenever you have a multi-billion dollar company that's looking to invest in our region and to create jobs and careers for individuals and families, I think we should have a more welcome attitude towards them.
Kevin Law, thank you so much for joining us today on The Full Story.
Hey, thank you.
All right, Kevin Law, the president and CEO of the Long Island Association. We're going to not necessarily shift gears. We're just going to make our way further out on the island because this week Southampton Town decided to ban plastic straws and polystyrene containers. Joining me now is Greg Wehner. He's the reporter, one of the reporters for the Southampton Press. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Becky. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the decision to ban the straws and the polystyrene containers, styrofoam, basically. What was the driving force behind this decision?
So, yeah, it's a coastal community here in Southampton. And so, you know, just anything that goes into the water is a concern for people out here, especially plastic, which doesn't break down. It's tough to recycle. It'll be around 400, 500 years later. It's just not good for the marine life out here. So, you know, officials worked with the Surf Rider Foundation to put a ban in place that covers the town of Southampton on plastic straws and polystyrene containers.
Many people think, how big a problem could it be? Some straws, you know, a couple of styrofoam cups here and there. But the numbers are really shocking that have been put together in terms of 1 year, what is typically discarded. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the group that put together the ban, the Southampton Town Sustainability Committee, they provided numbers that the town of Southampton discards, like, between residents and visitors, nearly 20 million straws and 8 million polystyrene foam cups a year, which that's based on the national average that I was given of 175 million straws per day in the country. So it's a huge number of plastic straws and styrofoam containers.
And I know that there are activists and local residents that comb the beaches. Tell me what they typically find in their cleanup efforts.
Yeah, so like even this past weekend, the Surf Rider did a beach cleanup at Tiana Beach, and I think they found about 300 pieces of polystyrene foam along the beach just within a couple hours of combing the beach. And they were all the size of, you know, less than a quarter. You know, and they've done, I was given hard numbers, out of about 10 beach cleanups, the Surf Rider Foundation has come up with 260 straws or something, somewhere around there.
So it certainly is a problem.
Absolutely.
Now, Southampton wasn't the first town to do this in your area. You're following on the heels of East Hampton. When did they put this ban in place?
So East Hampton Village put a straw ban in place back in September, or at least that's when it was voted in. And all of this, just to put into perspective, it kind of comes on the heels of a plastic ban straw plastic bag ban that's been going on out here on the island. Back in 2011, Southampton Village, they banned plastic bags, you know, and other communities in the area followed suit. And last year, Suffolk County, they banned plastic bags. So now when you go to the grocery store, you have to pay a nickel for every single plastic bag that you get. And this has been even picked up at the state level, to where Governor Andrew Cuomo is looking to possibly put a ban on plastic bags. And so for the town of Southampton, this was the straw ban and the polystyrene ban. They were in addition to the plastic bag ban. And they're hoping that, you know, other communities will follow suit. And, you know, as soon as this was passed by the town board on Tuesday, the next morning I had a press release from Suffolk County saying that one of the legislators there is proposing the same type of ban.
And what's the reaction been from business? Is this going to hurt them? Is this going to cost them more?
Whether or not it's going to cost them more, I'm not sure. But, you know, when the committee went out and interviewed a lot of the restaurants, I think they interviewed 80 out of 240. 90 to 95% of those who they interviewed and surveyed were in favor of the ban.
I know that we talked briefly, and you said that businesses don't need any extra birds, not that this is, but in other ways, that there have been some problems in Southampton Village in terms of businesses being able to hang in there. What are you seeing?
Right. Go ahead, sorry.
No, what are you seeing as you go through Southampton Village in terms of vacancies and companies that are closing their doors?
So, yeah, when you enter Southampton Village right now, there's a lot of empty storefronts. And just this year, two big staples that have been here for years have closed doors. One of them was Vineyard Vines, who'd been here for about 9 years, and then Twist, who'd been here for 17 years. I got to sit down with the owner of Twist, Valerie Revere, and she was telling me that, you know, after 17 years, she wasn't sure if she wanted to go into another 2 to 5 year lease because, you know, things are getting a little expensive. Every year the rents go up, and it's not just the rents that's hurting them. It's also online retailers. as well as pop-up stores. Pop-up stores are being given incentives, to fill the space just for the summer. It's kind of pricing out the long-term folks who have been here.
All right, Greg Wehner from the Southampton Press, a reporter for them. Thanks for bringing us up to date. We know you're kind of in your sleepy period now, but gearing up for a big summer, and we wish you the best of luck.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll be back with more on The Full Story. In Connecticut this week, progressive Democrat and Republican lawmakers both presented their policy agendas for this legislative session. The House Democratic Progressive Caucus revealed a series of tax proposals that would raise income taxes on wealthy households and resist attempts to repeal the estate tax. Meanwhile, the Senate Republican Caucus proposed bills that would reduce government costs by expanding public-private partnerships. For more on these competing agendas, we turn to WSHU senior political reporter Ibang Idoma, as well as Scott McLean, a professor of political science and chair of philosophy and political science at Quinnipiac University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Ibang, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Ibang, let's start with you in terms of the progressive Democrats. What were the policies that stood out to you as they put forth their agenda?
Well, basically, they have seven different areas that they're concentrating on. It includes what they call economic security, which has to do with raising the minimum wage and having family and medical leave. Public health and safety, which deals with the opioid crisis. Education, elections, having early voting and some social justice issues like issues dealing with reentry and allowing felons to get back onto the voting rolls. Here's how the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, Democratic Representative Joshua Hall of Hartford, here's how he described what their agenda is.
We talk about environmental justice, social justice, economic justice, educational opportunity, criminal justice, expanding the middle class, and racial justice. The key component for us is justice. And that means so much to all of us because you know that for far too long that there have been so many people left out of that process. And we're here as Progressive Caucus members to change that trajectory, change that narrative for the residents of the state of Connecticut.
Well, right off the bat, there was some pushback from Governor Lamont, who's been pretty supportive of most of the agenda, but when it came to the taxes, he wasn't buying into that.
The estate tax.
No, he wasn't. He seemed to push back on that.
Professor McLean, do you think, as Ibang is suggesting, this is the progressive agenda is driving a wedge between themselves and the larger Democratic Party?
Well, yes, but we have to remember that's what the left does. they propose big ideals and ideas and policy things that that the rest of the party has to contend with and decide what's going to be the strategy going forward. And so does the governor. The governor has to figure out how all of this would fit into his number one priority, which is to figure out how to pay for everything and to deal with the big hole in the state budget. And I think it's a foregone conclusion that many of these items will be delayed or put to the wayside or even rejected by the leadership of the Democratic Party in the House and Senate.
I know one of the things that probably concerns the governor as well with regard to these proposals is driving the rich out of the state of Connecticut, which we are already seeing happen in New York and Connecticut as well. The wealthy leaving the state to states with no income tax, for example.
Yeah, and I certainly would not claim to be an expert on what drives wealthy people to leave or to come into a state, and whether to what extent taxes have much to do with that. But I think the Democrats for a while have been basing their moves on the idea that it isn't just the
amount of tax that high-income individuals pay. What we're also seeing is people from middle incomes leaving because the current taxes that we have, tax system that's leaned so much on local property tax and fees, is also socking it to the middle class. And in the end, it's going to come down to whose political ox is going to be gored. Is it going to be a few people who are in the million-dollar range, or people who are middle income? And whose votes and whose presence do you care more about sticking around with the Democrats?
All right, let's shift now to the Republicans. Yvonne, the Republicans put forth their agenda as well. Public-private partnerships, that was part of the agenda, wasn't it?
Yes, basically they say that their agenda has to do with creating opportunities for growth. And, and basically that's focus more on the private sector. So they feel that, especially the Department of Motor Vehicles, they feel a lot of that can be done by private enterprise. We'll see how that works out. I don't know how far they'll go. You know, the Republicans are at a disadvantage this time around because their numbers have shrunk since last session. Last session, they had a 50-50 split in the Senate. So they were at the table for everything. So they've had to scale back their ambitions. They have... Let's have Senator Fasano say it in his own words. And Senator Fasano is the Republican leader in the Senate. This is how he described what their agenda would be.
Today really is about empowerment and how we can empower people to be successful. We do this by looking at the expanded access to child care and temporary assistance, workforce training, and purchases of new homes, trying to get folks who need some help the help they need.
So basically, yeah, it's very scaled back. Although, you know, they had a pleasant surprise yesterday when they were invited on Valentine's Day to the governor's mansion for a meeting with the governor.
Okay, so. Open to new ideas.
But so he reached chocolate out. Was involved. Exchange of chocolate, maybe.
Everyone was feeling the love. Very nice. Yeah, Len Fasano and the Republicans bring up this point about providing opportunity for all, growth, and you brought up, Scott, having to do with the middle class feeling the hit. This is particularly true with the cap on state and local tax deductions for federal returns. This has really hit the middle class hard, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And I think, you know, I have to keep coming. And I heard Yvonne sort of chuckle at this, that scaled back nature of the Republicans' ideas right now. They're not in the driver's seat. This is really going to be an internal battle with Democrats, particularly Democrats who come from suburban areas and Democrats who come from urban areas. I wouldn't go as far as to say that they were two different parties, but they have some, you know, major differences when it comes to questions of taxes and the agenda that the progressives have put forward. So, for example, are we going to focus primarily on funding for urban areas and restoring the payment in lieu of taxes program to its proper levels? Cities have been getting less than was promised from the state in as a compensation for the large amount of nonprofits that they are host to that cannot be taxed under state law. Those cities have not been getting the most that they could get. Meanwhile, we have the suburban Democrats and the voters in those places are not so worried about that. They're worried about it, you know, getting tax cuts. And I think when it all washes out, we're probably going to see increased taxes going towards people who have the highest incomes in the state. and taking the risk that they won't just all bolt for the door, go down, go up 95 and go to New Hampshire or something like this. I think that's a calculated risk that's going to be debated between those urban Democrats and suburban Democrats in the end. And also these questions about how we can begin to compensate for the moves at the federal level that have shut off the opportunity to write off your local taxes. The easiest thing I think that could be part of that exchange and the deal making that goes on, by the way, is just to grant cities the opportunity to institute some kind of an entertainment tax. Cities like New Haven, for example, could put a 1% tax on meals and cocktails and things that and theater tickets and show and concert tickets and so on. That could really help those cities and maybe was a way out of that impasse between urban and suburban and tax rates for the wealthier.
And right now, Lamont has this dilemma that he has to deal with because he got elected because of massive turnouts for him in the cities. So he has they're expecting something from him. And at the same time, he has to take into consideration that we are our financial situation is quite dire right now, and he doesn't want to get into using any of the rainy day fund. So how do you solve a $2 billion hole in the budget? It's going to be a tough thing for Lamont, and we'll see how he works it out when he presents his budget next week.
Well, Imbang, you bring up a good point. I mean, we're looking at $1.5 billion deficit for 1920 and then $2 billion for 2021. Those budgets, the rainy day fund, as you remarked, has grown from $200 million to $1.2 billion. The new governor says, I don't want to touch that. But historically, lawmakers in Hartford have dipped their hand to it.
Well, it's going to be difficult to do because they've got to balance the budget. And how do you do it without increasing revenue? It's tough. And basically, the projections are that the unfunded obligations that we have are just going to continue to increase into the future.
And pensions and things like that,
yes,
right?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, and Scott, that's a good point because the unions have said, we came to the table four times since 2003. We have negotiated with you. We're not doing that again. Are they going to be able to hold by that? And what kind of a stance is Lamont going to be able to take, the new governor take, to get something in terms of dealing with the fact that these pensions were the deferred payments for so many years and now it's time to pay up?
Well, yes, and the bill does come due eventually, and I think encased in what you just said is the real point. The unions have conceded in the past. The unions have dealt with governors who also deal with the problem by giving pink slips to a lot of state workers, and so understaffing a lot of programs, many of which are very popular programs. So I think right now in that kind of a negotiation, the unions have most of the cards. The Democrats are very dependent on urban voters for winning their statewide majorities, and those urban voters are strongly mobilized by the work of public unions, university unions, and even other kinds of unions that are stronger in the cities.
In the end,
they're going to say, we've conceded before. It's time we dealt with this in some other way than just the unions giving another concession.
Well, I think it was interesting because I spoke with Lamont about this a couple of days ago, and he ruled out talking with the public employee unions about any more concessions. However, he did say he was reaching out to the teachers unions and seeing if he could try and work a way to either scale back the benefits or stretch out the obligations. But he said he was talking with the teachers' unions.
All right, and the governor has his big budget address coming up this next week.
On Wednesday.
On Wednesday. He's talking about a debt diet. Explain to us, Yvonne, what that means and what impact that will have on the state.
Well, what he did, he went, the past 8 years, we borrowed a lot of money. Most of the school construction, most of the municipal infrastructure is bonded. And last year we bonded about $1.7 billion. So Lamont is saying that he's scaling that back to about $900 million this year and going forward. He's going to try and keep it down. He says he's not going to touch any ongoing projects, but future projects probably will not happen. And he also made the point that he would still fund school projects in the urban areas of the state, but in many of the suburban areas and the rural areas of the state where he says the school population is even going down, that he doesn't see any new school construction there.
All right. There's been some talk, too, that the governor will have to broaden the state sales tax. Scott, the governor says there's an area in terms of digital services and transactions that has been untapped in terms of sales tax. Is that an area he should turn to?
Well, I think it's an all-of-the-above thing now when the state is going to start looking for things to tax. You know, I think what we're really looking at here is the governor expressing the things that he doesn't want to do, like he doesn't want more bonding. We're talking about cutting back on building schools. But we have to remember, you know, our infrastructure in the state of Connecticut is crumbling as we speak. And so we really need to think about more ways to finance those kinds of projects and to keep them going. You can't sort of forget about it for a while. You can only patch potholes for so long. Everyone loves patched potholes, but we have bigger problems: bridges, trains, and so on, bus lines that need to be supported. I just think in the end the writing is on the wall that there's going to be some kind of tax increase, and whether it comes from localities who are given new authority to tax, or whether it's going to be new fees, or whether it's going to be a 1% millionaire surtax, we're really looking at raising more money.
Would you agree? About 30 seconds. Would you agree with that? Increased taxes are on the horizon.
Some way, somehow, there's got to be more revenue. That's the bottom line.
It just doesn't add up. Doesn't add up any other way.
Yeah, the math is just not working out. All right, Yvonne Odoma, we want to thank you. You didn't have to travel too far.
No.
WSHU senior
Thanks, Rebecca.
Political reporter. Also joining me, Scott McLean, professor of political science and chair of the philosophy and political science department at Quinnipiac University. And that's the full story for this week. I'm Rebecca Saran. We'll see you soon.